case of the morning. It's Employees Mutual Casualty versus John Scutaris. Mr. Etzler, are you first? You proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Gordon Etzler, and I represent John Scutaris, who is the defendant appellant in this case. This appeal involves the application of Indiana law to the process of adjusting a fire loss under an insurance policy. We are talking today about only 50% of that loss. The other portion, the other 50% of the loss, was settled with Ohio Casualty, and this lawsuit only involves Hamilton Mutual and the other 50% of the loss. The restaurant was destroyed by fire in early April of 2000.
Just so it's totally clear, how much would that 50% be in dollars?
How much in dollars? Mm-hmm. The total claim, Your Honor, was approximately $850,000.
Right. And now $425,000 is what you're saying?
Approximately, yes.
Okay. And it's hard and to, you know.
How much did Hamilton actually pay?
If I may explain, there was the two policies had overlapping coverage. And except for some small items like the parking lot, the computer, and the sign, where I believe Hamilton Mutual had the coverage for those items, Ohio Casualty did not.
Has Hamilton paid $128,000 or something like that?
Hamilton has paid $127,000, approximately $127,000, as an interim payment under the policy. They were required to pay an interim payment equal to the fair cash value. The policy was a replacement cost policy, which required them then once the facility was reconstructed to pay the entire amount.
So do we subtract the 127 from the 425?
Yes, that is
okay.
Correct.
It's really hard to...
It is. It's a difficult concept. And that was one of the issues that we had on the issue of bad faith, Your Honors. Hamilton Mutual had three appraisals made of the real estate and the personal property. This was a new facility. It had been operated only about 6 weeks, and then it was totally destroyed by fire. They depreciated, and reaching the actual cash value, that you would compute the replacement cost value and then deduct depreciation to arrive at the actual cash value. And that would be the amount of the interim payment. But what they did is they depreciated the property, both the real estate and the personality, by 40 to 60%, depending upon the item, which we thought for all brand new property only being used for 6 weeks was just not appropriate and fair. And that's one of the issues that we had with them in trying to adjust this loss.
And just another sort of question up front. I'm curious why your client wouldn't submit to an examination under oath for the building and the personal property claims.
Well, that, Your Honor, that was a miscommunication. During this, the loss occurred in April 2002. There was a public adjuster involved with Mr. John Scutaris. There was adjuster involved for Hamilton Mutual and Ohio Casualty, each having separate adjusters. However, Hamilton Mutual, through the process, were the lead adjusters. Mm-hmm. And through those months until about November 2002, when I got involved, they had made all these appraisals, exchanged all the documentation, and the payment, the partial payment, had already been made. In November 2002, there was a meeting where all of this was discussed and trying to resolve it for everyone. And at that meeting, one of the items of loss was whether or not the building should be, whether or not the basement and a foundation should be considered a total loss. Hamilton Mutual took the position it was not. It could be saved. However, the local building inspector and the state fire marshal said that there was so much damage by the fire and by the water that it had to be removed. After they were presented with that evidence, then they agreed to increase their adjustment up to about $57,000. After that, in the latter part of December and January of 2001, it was then decided that there were issues of valuation of the real estate and personal property, and that we were so far apart that we would never be able to resolve that.
Well, but there was go ahead. I'm sorry.
Then we agreed to go to an appraisal, to the appraisal process. And that was agreed by both parties, by the insurance company and by John Kateri.
But there was no limit in the policy on Hamilton's ability to take an examination under oath after the appraisal process had begun, was there?
No, there wasn't. But what they wanted, there's a letter, I think, of February 13th of 2001 that was sent by the attorney for Hamilton requesting all of the documentation that had been provided before. And we had gone through correspondence. And I might say parenthetically that there were a lot of letters presented on the motion for summary judgment that the attorney for Hamilton sent to me, but it doesn't include the letters that I responded, nor the phone calls we had about these matters. But there was this communication back and forth. There wasn't a process of ignoring what was being done.
So bottom line, it was a judgment call not to, to submit him under oath?
Well, it was a judgment call because I really felt at that time that this was going to go to litigation. It was going to go to appraisal, which was under the Superior Court, our county Superior Court system. And I knew that we had to have a third party come into the process because the parties would not be able to do it.
I don't know how you divided your time here, but
I think I've probably taken...
Well, I don't... It's
what
up to you.
Let me conclude, Your Honor, by saying that we had presented all the documents we had. There was one appraisal from the bank that a lot is made of. That appraisal was performed by the bank for bankruptcy proceedings before John Kateri ever got involved and did not have anything to do with his purchase, had nothing to do with the personal property.
So that's why he didn't agree to sign the authorization that would have allowed Hamilton to seek those documents directly from the bank? Is that what you're saying?
We permitted, in fact, John met with the bankers, with Mr. Hall, who's the adjuster for the Hamilton Mutual, and the bank said they would give them all of their documents.
Right.
We did not know there was even an appraisal that was done months before until after John had taken his deposition. And it, frankly, is an irrelevant appraisal. It appraises the property before it was even purchased by John and before it was rebuilt, before the restaurant was built. And it had to do with perfecting their mortgage security interest to acquire abandonment through the bankruptcy court by Porter Bank, not for John. He wasn't even involved in the process at that time. So that they make a lot about that appraisal, but it had nothing to do with John's transaction. I would let Kevin Kerr do the rest of the presentation.
Okay, how much time do they have cumulatively left?
6 minutes.
Okay, you got 6 minutes, including rebuttal.
Your Honor, my name is Kevin Kerr, and I represent Mr. Skateris in this matter. I think that the fundamental error demonstrated in the district court's decision granting summary judgment was holding essentially that the failure to attend an examination under oath creates an irrebuttable presumption of prejudice on the part of the insurer in the investigation of a loss.
I did not get an answer, and maybe I didn't ask the question properly, but what I was wondering was this. If Mr.
Skouteris,
believed that the bank was supposed to forward all of the relevant documents to Hamilton, why didn't he agree to sign the authorization allowing Hamilton to seek those documents directly from the bank once it was apparent that Hamilton hadn't received those documents?
Your Honor, the reason for that is, first, John believed that the bank had forwarded everything that it had. He had no way of knowing that some documents had been omitted. He had no knowledge of what was in the bank prior to his transactions with the bank. And this appraisal is a pre-purchase appraisal that was created. There was a request for an authorization, which is, I think you're referring to Mr. Stiver's request for an authorization. That request was forwarded to Mr. Zeke. He never had any contact with John. To the best of my knowledge, Mr. Zeke decided not to ask John for an authorization to permit that, as he had no duty or obligation under the appraisal provision or under the court's order establishing the appraisal to share information with Hamilton's appraiser in this matter.
But it was never
forwarded to John, so he didn't refuse to sign it. He didn't know that they at that point didn't know that they wanted it. The appraisers were conducting it. Your Honor, under Miller's versus Dilt, a decision of the Indiana Supreme Court that was decided subsequent to the Boyd decision relied upon by Hamilton, the court made it very clear that Indiana has a public policy which favors the payment of otherwise legitimate claims and limits an insurer's ability to deny coverage for what is otherwise a legitimate claim without the showing of material prejudice.
Well, wouldn't a rule requiring an insurer to show prejudice from an insured's failure to submit it to an examination under oath, which is what our situation is here, be difficult when the insurer doesn't know what information it might have obtained?
That would indeed be the case, Your Honor, but in this case we have had extensive discovery after the matter to determine what was and was not revealed or purportedly revealed by the insured. In this case, they very expressly said, this is the things that we said that we wanted that we didn't get. And we've had an opportunity to review those, submit those to the court, and submit those to the district court for summary judgment proceedings. In this case, there has been nothing submitted which shows a material prejudice in the appraisal process. And there's a little bit of a problem here with their argument to begin with. To show prejudice in the context of this claim, they must show that the appraisal would somehow have been made different by information that they secured subsequent to submitting this matter to the appraisers. Their appraiser testified that he would not consider information from his principal, that he would not go back to his principal, and that the appraisal process was intended to take them completely out of the process. In fact, he testified that he could not verify that this claim for a raised building was a total loss. This is despite the fact that Hamilton inspected the loss, did a thorough job over 8 months of inspecting the loss, were out of the site, and agreed that it was a total loss. But their appraiser felt that it was improper for him to make the same conclusion relying on the information provided to him by his principal. And his principal had ample opportunity to appraise this loss, to calculate the dimensions of the buildings, the nature of the buildings, a cinder block building, nothing unusual about it, no reason why their appraiser could not rely on the information produced, except that he chose not to. And in this case, there is no way that, assuming that they could have gotten information, and that this information was material, which are two assumptions, that there is no showing of any kind that they could have gotten this to the appraisers, because Mr. Stivers certainly testified that he wouldn't consider it, and there's no testimony regarding whether or not Mr. Milbrandt or Mr. Zeke would have considered it, and whether or not any of the information that we have subsequently discovered would have affected their appraisals in any way. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks. Mr. Hewlett?
If it pleases the court, my name is Jerry Hewlett. I represent Employers Mutual Insurance Company and Hamilton Mutual Insurance Company. My associate, Mike Crepin, is here with me today as well. Judge, I'd like to answer the question that you asked of Mr. Etzler earlier, or that you did, Judge. Why didn't Mr. Skateris attend the statement under oath? I've asked that question for 2 years. And today, I still don't know why Mr. Skateris did not attend the statement under oath. I cannot understand the basis of the refusal to permit Mr. Skateris to attend the statement under oath, because the statement, as any lawyer would know, getting information, it's a deposition, getting this information is so important to the claims evaluation process and moving forward with the process.
Let me try to articulate what my problem with the magistrate judge's opinion is and see if you can help me out.
Yes, ma'am.
The failure of Mr. Skateris to attend the examination under oath, the district court concluded that that was a violation of the duty to provide notice. But Hamilton was clearly on notice of his claims and acted accordingly. The conduct at issue here, more logically it seems, would fall into the category of a failure to cooperate. And in order to comply with the cooperation requirement, Hamilton needs to demonstrate prejudice. And my problem is I don't think that we can hold as a matter of law whether prejudice was demonstrated here with this magistrate's opinion. In fact, I thought your brief only kind of made a half-hearted effort to support the district court's characterization of the conduct as a failure to provide notice. And you tell me if I'm wrong.
I don't like to tell any judge that she's wrong, Your Honor.
You can tell me.
Your Honor, I think the point's well taken. And in deference to the lower court's decision, I believe that the efforts of Judge Cherry in this case in writing an opinion that I think is 38 or 42 pages long, the incredible amount of time and effort that the lower court spent on reviewing the record and methodically and carefully showing the conflicts in the record in terms of their representation of facts, I did not believe that the lower court's ruling needed amplification. But I understand what your question is here. You're asking, is under Indiana law, do we need to prove prejudice if the insured fails to attend a statement under oath? And I believe that the answer to that question is no. The lower court specifically looked at the issue of the failure to appear, looked at the difference between the cooperation clause and the clause that requires the insured to attend a statement under oath, and concluded that they're different. The court went to a great deal of effort looking at the Miller versus Diltz decision, decisions from this court talking about issues of prejudice and whether or not a failure to attend an EUO constitutes a breach of the cooperation clause or it's something different. And what Judge Cherry ruled, and we would ask the court to accept, is simply this. The failure to attend a statement under oath is a material breach of the policy. It's substantive. The court pointed out that this part of the proceeding is so important to the claims investigation process that to suggest that you can simply ignore a request to attend and then later say you have to prove prejudice ignores a basic investigative tool. It is no difference than the notice provision that the Supreme Court talked about in Miller versus Diltz.
When you have the umpire consistently rejecting your arguments that there wasn't enough documentation and evidence during the appraisal process?
The umpire's rejection of the documents, we didn't have any information or records. This is what we wanted. We couldn't present the information to the umpire and to the appraisers.
Let me ask you this. What is, if we disagree with you and we find that prejudice was required under Indiana law, what's the strongest argument, the best case that you can make that you were prejudiced, other than just saying that obviously we're prejudiced because it's integral to the investigation that he should have cooperated?
Excellent question, Judge. And let me answer the question simply this way. We didn't know until after the a lawsuit had been filed that Mr. Hoffman had the appraisal on the building showing that the actual cash value of the building was about $200,000. He came up with an appraisal of almost $500,000. We didn't have the information that when the building was purchased, that most of the personal property in the building was included in the purchase price. We could not present that information to the appraisers and to the umpire. We did not have that information. We could not tell the appraisers and the umpire, Your Honor, that in this particular case, Mr. Hoffman's evaluation on the real property was over $600,000 and the personal property was over $300,000. And you know how he came up with that estimate? He didn't look at books or records. He just made a judgment call. He said, this is what I think they're worth. And you can find that in the transcript at page 298. He admits that he never consulted any record or document in coming up with the opinions and conclusions of the values. In other words, can you imagine the insurance company sending some adjuster out, and he sits around and he says, well, I think that widget's worth $50, and I think that couch is worth $35. That's, in essence, what Mr. Hoffman did.
But isn't the problem here that the initial EUO in the letter that was sent in January of 2001 indicate that the examination under oath was requested to determine any time element loss which related to the calculation of the business interruption claim rather than the losses that were related to the building or the personal property?
Initially, you're correct in your evaluation or review of the record, Judge. That's exactly what the first letter said.
Well, then didn't he comply, didn't Mr. Skouteris comply with that request in offering to attend this examination any time in the, I think it was the subsequent 10 days,
It was in October of 2001, Your Honor.
The business interruption loss.
The answer, you can hate to disagree with you, Judge, but the answer is no, because less than 30 days later, I enter my appearance and I send a letter to Mr. Etzler. That's the one dated February 13, 2001, clearly telling him that I'm going to take the statement under oath as to all matters, and I list some 27 or 30 specific documents that I need.
So, do all those document requests in the letter of February 13th relate to the business interruption loss?
No, ma'am. They relate to all aspects of it, and you can find that in the court's record at page 186. You will see that in the record, Your Honor, that I asked for the purchase agreement, the appraisal prepared on the property, both real and personal, a list of all improvements. I wanted to know what figures Mr. Hoffman utilized in coming up to a figure of $630,000 for the building and personal property.
I wanted the engineering reports, canceled checks, photographs, a list of the personal properties included in the purchase price of the building when it was purchased. I wanted all of these things. And then later on, just 2.5 months later, when I still didn't have an opportunity to take Mr. Skateris' sworn statement, I wrote him a letter and said I have the right to take his statement relating to all matters placed in issue. All matters placed in issue had to do with all three issues. And the lower court found, Your Honor, that it was clear that my client wanted to take the sworn statement as to all issues, not just the business personal property. So the tender or offer later on in October of 01, offering to make him available for just the one EUO for the business, is not consistent with the record. As a matter of fact, Mr. Skateris testified that he knew that I wanted to take his statement as to all matters placed in issue, and he knew it before. Judge, I want to just address one particular question on the prejudice issue.
Yeah, and the other thing is, given the dispute as to how things occurred and the timing and whether you wanted everything or it was limited, and counsel's position that you had all the documentation that you needed, shouldn't a jury determine whether or not you were prejudiced, assuming there's that obligation?
No, ma'am. Specifically, the court found, and in his opinion, the lower court found that all documents were not supplied. As a matter of fact, the truth of the record is that Skateris gave the records to Hoffman, his adjuster. Hoffman testified that he never gave it to anyone. The court concluded that we never received those records, and that is a fact in this record. So they did not produce the records. The issue of prejudice and what Indiana law is on prejudice is very important in this case. The Boyd decision talks about the fact that the failure to attend an EUO constitutes a material breach of the cooperation clause. 1 year later, we have Miller versus Diltz. In the Miller versus Diltz decision, that the Supreme Court talked about the difference between the cooperation clause and the notice provision. Interestingly enough, there wasn't an issue dealing with the EUO. That came down just recently in the Morris decision versus Economy Insurance. How is that different? In the new decision, it just came out of the Court of Appeals, Judge. The court concluded that the insured did not refuse to attend the statement under oath. That's what the court concluded. The insured wanted to attend the statement under oath. So that new decision that's been referred to by counsel in their briefs changes nothing. That new decision does not change the bare bones fact is that when you don't attend the EUO, it constitutes a material breach of the policy. Judge, on page 5, I've thought about this many times in trying to prepare my arguments. How would I explain the difference between the court's opinion in Boyd to the new decision in Morris versus Economy? And the answer is simply this. In the Boyd decision, the court said at page 1078, turning to the cases cited by Mutual, that was Standard Mutual, we first observe that they consistently do hold that an insured's unexcused failure to appear and submit to an examination under oath as required by the insurance contract constitutes an absolute defense to an action on the policy by the insured. And then in footnote number 2, and I think this is instructive for this court, it says here at page 1079, there is absolutely no evidence in the record which would show that Mutual is using the requirement, that is to take the EUO, as an unfair tactic to deny Boyd recovery on this loss. I think what the court is saying to us, as you do in your opinions, there's no evidence of any attempt to take unfair advantage in the Boyd decision. The insured was given an opportunity to attend a statement under oath, and he refused. On the other hand, in the new decision for Economy, there was an unfair attempt to take advantage of the insured. The insured, the wife was blind, the husband had some sort of disability, the insurance company had statements from these folks and refused to provide them with copies of their statements before their sworn statement under oath. And the Court of Appeals rightly said, this is wrong. These people wanted to attend their statement under oath, but they wanted to be prepared just like your lawyers were. And I agree with that decision, and I applaud the decision. That's different, Your Honor, than in this case and in the Boyd case, where the insured, in a truculent matter, said, I am not going to attend the statement under oath. I believe that there is significant evidence that the insured willfully and intentionally refused to attend
There was no excuse or justification for it.
You know, let's be fair to Mr. Skateris here. He did offer to attend an EOU.
As to one issue.
Anytime in that subsequent 10 days relating to the business interruption.
Yes, ma'am. You're right.
He didn't just say no.
Yeah, and I don't mean to suggest anything to the contrary. He said that clearly. But his lawyer and the letter that his lawyer sent to me is in your record here, clearly said that he was not going to make him available for the business real property and the business personal property.
So it was very limited, his appearance.
Yes, ma'am.
And I have another final question. If we were to rule against you and find that Hamilton improperly denied the claim, wouldn't you be bound by the umpire's decision?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why not?
I believe that exceptional circumstances clearly set forth in our brief demonstrates that it was unfair. We were not permitted to present the umpire and the appraisers with all the information that we now know that's been presented to you in this record. We did not have that information to present to the umpires and to the appraisers. We believe, had they had that information, that the umpires and the appraisers would have reevaluated the damage evaluation, but they didn't have it. They had nothing. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Let's see, I guess it's Mr. Kerr, or who's going to rebuttal?
May I?
All right, what, he's got about a minute? He's got 1 minute. That's it, because you went a long time on the first run.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of things that I'd like to clarify. First of all, he said that the appraisal, the bank appraisal, was at $200,000, but he failed to advise the court that Mr. Kateris had, with borrowed money from the bank, had put in another $130,000 into the project and had put an additional $50,000 to $60,000 of his own cash into this project in the reconstruction, and that Mr. Kateris was the general contractor on his own of doing this project. When you talk about value, it isn't $200,000 or $250,000, it's much more than that. Secondly, all of the bank's documents have been presented to Hamilton Mutual through discovery. There wasn't a lot. And I don't want to explain or give reasons why the bank did not have a lot of documentation, but they did not. And they took this back from bankruptcy and was sold to John Kateris as is, where is. And that's, there was no inventory. There was no valuation of inventory or personal property. Secondly,
let's wrap it up.
When we agreed to go to appraisal in January, we had agreed that all of the documentation was there for the personal property and the real estate. When Mr. Hewlett came back into the scene, that did not mean that we had to provide all of the documentation again that was presented to the adjuster, to Mr. Hewlett. Also, I want to say that in October 3rd, when he set that statement, I was out of the country. I was in Lebanon, and I could not do it at that time, and I gave him a time when he could do it. Now, I did limit it to the business interruption claim, but that's what we had agreed to do back in January through his appraiser.
I think that's it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thanks. This case will be taken under advisement.